Case number 19-5288, Enri, application of the Committee on the Judiciary, U.S. House of Representatives, for an order authorizing the release of certain grand jury materials, Committee on the Judiciary, United States House of Representatives versus United States Department of Justice Appellant. Mr. Freeman for Appellant U.S. Department of Justice. Mr. Letter for Appellate House Committee on the Judiciary. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Mark Freeman for the Department of Justice. The District Court in this case denied the government's request for a stay pending appeal so that this Court could have an opportunity to review the important questions presented. The Court denied that motion even though it's clear that once the grand jury secrets at issue are disclosed, they can't be undisclosed. The bell can't be unrung after the fact. The Court denied that motion nonetheless because, effectively, she thought she was right on the merits. But as we've explained in our motion, the District Court committed at least two serious errors of law in granting the request for disclosure.
You start with irreparable harm. It is the case, however, that if we agreed with the District Court on the two prongs of the merits argument we're about to get to, that irreparable harm is not that important, is it?
Oh, I disagree with that completely, Your Honor. Our contention in this case.
I mean, if we thought that you were likely to lose on the merits, what significance is irreparable harm?
Well, I agree with you as a stay showing. We have to show a likelihood of success in the merits.
Right.
If you don't agree that we have that, then we don't get the stay. I agree with that. But in terms of the irreparable injury, I mean, this is the disclosure of grand jury information from a massive federal criminal investigation that concluded only 8 months ago. There are almost 25 pending criminal matters that are come out of that proceeding. There are 2,800 criminal grand jury subpoenas issued in connection.
And which of those relate directly to the redacted material that...
How does that relate? Well, that's exactly...
Specifically.
Yes, and that's the point on our second argument, which is that that's the committee's burden to demonstrate that.
Well, I suggest to you that the district court's findings, plus the special counsel's report, volume 2, plus what the committee said in supplementing its statements during oral argument, seem to specify why it thinks certain material is necessary for the committee to proceed. And you have said it's not enough repeatedly, but when counsel was asked by the district court, what test are you relying on and what authority, counsel provided nothing.
This is government counsel. Well, I think the test that we're relying
on... Counsel for the Department of Justice.
Yes, Your Honor. The test that we're relying on, as we explained very clearly in the district court, is the test in Douglas Oil itself.
Yes, and what does Douglas Oil say?
It says you have to show a need to avoid a specific possible injustice in another judicial proceeding, that you have to show that the interests in secrecy are outweighed by the interest in disclosure, and that the disclosure can be tailored to that particular injustice.
The district court found that test had been met.
Your Honor,
why was the district court clearly erroneous in its findings?
The district court committed the same error of law that this court found in the In Re Sealed Case decision in 1986, mm-hmm. that the Supreme Court found in Douglas Oil. There's no doubt that a district court that makes a reasoned, particularized, fact-specific finding is entitled to deference.
What specifically is the error?
The error is granting the release of grand jury information on the premise that applicant needs all relevant information.
But that is not what the district court found. The district court found, in terms of the committee's request as tailored, that it had met its burden.
Your Honor, the tailoring here is only that they asked for all grand jury redactions in the entire Mueller report.
No, they didn't. You keep saying that, but that's not what they asked for specifically. They were quite clear as to what they were seeking to the extent they could surmise what might have been said and by whom to the grand jury.
Your Honor, if I may, respectfully, what the committee came in and said is, we think there may be things in this grand jury information in the Mueller report that might bear on a theory that we would put forward for impeachment.
Actually, they were much more specific than that, counsel. You're more familiar with the record than I am,
Your Honor. Yes, and that is what they said. They said their first submission was,
went down the list of witnesses who they thought could provide this necessary information.
Yes, Your Honor. The first witness they identified was Don McGahn. And as it turned out, Don McGahn never testified in front of the grand jury at all.
He was not the only one.
But that was the primary thing in their petition. I mean, look, if this was...
But it wasn't, counsel. I mean, I'm reading the papers. You're reading the papers. It was not the only thing. And at least as to Douglas Oil's test,
yes,
the district court made these findings. And I'm unclear what standard the department is saying Douglas Oil or... other authority when, indeed, I thought, and maybe I'm mistaken, counsel to the department backed off the notion that the committee was expected to know who had testified, the scope of their testimony, and therefore be able to relate specifically why that witness's testimony was necessary.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. That has been the department's submission all along. Our view is that this works. The committee is here saying, and I'd like to address the premise.
But how could they? Just tell me practically, if it's secret and they don't know it, how can they say more than they did?
That is exactly the proposition the Supreme Court rejected in Abbott and Associates, where the Attorney General of California made exactly that point. Look, the way this works in any normal judicial proceeding, right?
But in that case, it was different, counsel, and you know that. I'm just trying to understand, as a conceptual matter,
yes,
where grand jury testimony is secret.
Yes.
The person or entity seeking the information doesn't know who testified or specifically what they said. Yet they know, based on the special counsel's report, that there were certain elements that were unavailable to it, and it deferred on making any specific finding of criminal activity.
Right, and that is no different from how it works in any normal proceeding. To answer your question directly, how is a party to know that there is relevant grand jury testimony? Well, first, grand jury secrecy does not bind witnesses. So what often happens in these cases, in a criminal case or a civil case, is a party comes in and they say, well, I know, this person tells me that they testified to the grand jury on this fact. Now there's testimony to the same factual question in this judicial proceeding, and I want to use that specific testimony to contradict that particular proposition.
So are you calling for a redaction by redaction review?
Yeah. Yes, I think they have to, Your Honor, and I think it's telling that the first time and only time that Judge Howell pressed counsel on that, they agreed that they didn't need that information, and yet the district court gave them that information anyway. That is not how Rule 6E is supposed to work.
Now, you've used the phrase normal proceeding several times, but this isn't a normal proceeding, is it? I mean, the premise of the Mueller report, as I understand it, is that for allegations of presidential misconduct, those were not to be taken up by the Department of Justice. They were taken up by the House of Representatives. Now, why doesn't that change the nature of our inquiry here?
Well, I think it does change the nature of the inquiry in that we're not dealing with a judicial proceeding in the sense of...
Well, we'll get to that separately. Yes. Let's imagine we disagree with you. Let's imagine we think McKeever applies here.
Okay.
And I know you'll get to that.
Yes.
But on that premise, isn't this different in terms of the showing of particularized need necessary because the Mueller report was never going to identify the allegations of presidential misconduct?
Well, no, I don't think that's right at all, Your Honor. In fact, the point of the Mueller report was to identify that, and I think the Mueller report made that clear.
It was clear from the Mueller report that any allegations of presidential misconduct were to be handled by the political branches and not by Congress and not by the Department of Justice.
Right. Any legal ramifications, any legal consequences for it? Yes. Right. But the point of the Mueller report is, I think,
that's sort of the history here, right? The independent counsel, the special counsel, they create fact finding, they engage in fact finding, and they pass it along to the House of Representatives.
And the point I'm trying to make is that's what the Mueller report did on the obstruction of justice question. Their Mueller report is 186 pages of detailed factual recitation. There are only five redactions in that entire section, the one of which counsel gave up at district court saying they had no need for. I mean, the House...
But are you suggesting the Mueller report didn't have the same objective in line with the Russian interference?
No, of course it did. And on the Russian interference sections, hundreds and hundreds of pages. And there are some substantial number of redactions, as you would expect. But precisely because the House of Representatives has all of this information in front of it, it's incumbent upon them, as it would be incumbent upon any litigant in a civil proceeding, to come forward, or any judicial proceeding, if that's the hypothesis, to come forward and say, okay, I've read the 186 pages, including the 181 pages with no redactions whatsoever, and I am unable to establish this one particular point, and that point is relevant to my article of impeachment or my cause of action, and I need that information for that reason. And nothing like that was shown in this case.
Wasn't the proffer that people may have misstated information, which the committee identified, and that in terms of presidential motivation, the information that the committee identified was quite specific as to what it needed, although, as I've said and we've discussed, it didn't know who testified or specifically what they said to the grand jury.
And on that point, and I'll repeat this, that is no different than the position of any litigant applying for a 6E order. That's the whole point of grand jury secrecy, and that's the conundrum always faced under Rule 6E. But to your point...
So when is the result of that analysis that the district court abused its discretion in ruling that it could, under the rule for the exception for judicial proceedings, kind of making your argument on that issue.
Yeah.
Abuse of discretion.
Yes, and let me explain why. If a party in a regular trial, criminal trial, and let's assume a big criminal trial, a trial arising out of the Mueller report, a trial of historic proportions, someone comes to this court and says, I'm the defendant, my liberty is at stake, I think a witness who is testifying in here, I don't know, but I want to make sure they didn't testify inconsistently in front of the grand jury. Now, no one's told me I have reason to think that, but I want to make sure of that because this is really important. That motion is denied under Rule 6E.
But if they say we have evidence from prosecutions brought successfully by the department that people have misstated things.
As to those people, then you would have a particularized need. But they have not made that showing here.
But they have made the showing, haven't they? That other people may have.
Sure. I mean, there was a perfect... Michael Cohen was convicted of lying to Congress. Roger Stone was just convicted of lying to Congress. But they didn't come in and say, we believe that we have testimony in front of us that is undermined by testimony of another witness. What they said was, other people have lied to Congress, and so we think we should get to see everything just to make sure no one else did. You would never accept that from a witness, from a litigant in a criminal case or in a civil case. That is not how Rule 6E works. And indeed, that's exactly the error that the Supreme Court found in Douglas Oil. In that case, there had been a criminal antitrust investigation, a grand jury proceeding, and then a party came in and said, well, we'd like the same information in order to establish our civil cause of action.
Mr. Freeman, I'd like to take a step back and ask you about our jurisdiction in this case. So although this hasn't been raised, we, of course, have an obligation to make sure that we have jurisdiction. And so in the Supreme Court's decision in the Judge Nixon case, the Supreme Court held that they could not review impeachment decisions of the Senate. And they also suggest that it would be inappropriate for the court to assist or interfere with impeachment proceedings.
Yes.
So is our involvement in this, I mean, is interpreting 6E, the judicial proceeding prong of that, to include impeachments, would that impermissibly involve this court in an impeachment proceeding?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. We've not made that argument. If it would be impermissible for this court to interfere, then it was impermissible for the district court to grant the application.
Well, we have to make sure we have jurisdiction, so yes.
Well, right, but this court would always have jurisdiction to decide then that the district court lacked jurisdiction. But I do want to say, we are not advancing that argument. The district court issued an injunction to the Department of Justice to reveal grand jury information to the House of Representatives in 5 days. We certainly have both standing and jurisdiction for us to seek a remedy from that order, and we think that it's wrong because we don't think, for the, I think the premise of Your Honor's question, that a impeachment proceeding in the legislative branch is a judicial proceeding in the sense of Rule 60 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure.
I know you didn't argue it, but I think it's an interesting question. Could you address it, whether there's a jurisdictional bar to us looking at an impeachment proceeding?
So again, this issue is not addressed.
I think
the answer to that question is there isn't a jurisdictional bar. The committee came in under Rule 57.6 of the Local Rules of the District Court, which provides that any person, a newspaper, anybody may come in and ask in a pending case, and there is the by supposition this is the district court's supervision of the grand jury, and ask for an order. And once the district court issues that order, then, of course, the Department of Justice, as the custodian of grand jury information, has the right to seek review of that order. It would make no sense that the court could grant it, but we couldn't seek review of it.
It doesn't go to your review. It goes to the district court deciding the issue in the first place.
I agree. And we have not challenged, and this is if, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post come in and ask for grand jury information, district court reviews that under Local Rule 57.6. We have not challenged that is a miscellaneous action properly heard by a district court, which could be the result.
But the suggestion is this is an impeachment inquiry, and that changes the way we should look at it.
That changes our involvement in this dispute.
I think if the conclusion is that the federal judiciary, I mean, put it this way, we do, as the court is well aware, have concerns with the standing of House of Representatives to file civil actions against the executive branch to raise arguments and assert error in the exercise of executive power. We think those are not Article III cases or controversies of the kind that courts have historically adjudicated. That's not this case. That is many other cases pending in district court and in the courts of appeals. But if we do think that there are Article III problems with the House of Representatives trying to create cases or controversies in the federal courts, we've not advanced that argument here. I agree that the court would need to decide it if it wanted to, if it thinks there's a serious question there. And if there is, respectfully, I think that's just another reason to grant a stay pending appeal and hear the important questions in this case. Now, I do want to go just finish the thought on particularized need. I'm not aware of any case, in which the court has held that a stated need to see all relevant evidence or to complete the story or to investigate fully, these are all the phrases from the district court's opinion at pages 66 to 69, has been an adequate showing under Rule 6E3E1. It just is not. Now, I think the committee's argument is that's basically not fair to them because how are they supposed to know? This is an impeachment proceeding. They're supposed to be conducting an investigation. How could they know what to look for? But respectfully, I think that just begs the premise about whether they're in the right bucket under Rule 6E at all. As we've explained, a judicial proceeding in the sense of Rule 6E is a proceeding in front of a court, federal court, state, or a local court. Now,
Friedman, help me here.
Yes.
In your view, then, for the committee to at least make a better argument, the department's position is it must be able to tell the district court, assuming the district court has jurisdiction, that we want the grand jury testimony of witness A because witness A testified as to events 1, 2, and 3, which the committee is investigating in terms of determining whether or not to file charges.
And
is that the kind of showing?
Yes, and they would have to say we are unable in our own authority to obtain the information about event 1, 2, and 3.
So I'm not going to add that, all right? Because there's several ways to, skin a cat. But what I'm trying to understand is then the department's position is that where a witness testifies before the grand jury, unless that witness reveals voluntarily the nature of its testimony, either in interviews with the media or otherwise in other litigation, then a party under Rule 61E exception for a judicial proceeding to obtain an order from the district court. I just need to be clear, because you
That is not the only way, but it has to be.
Give me another way.
It has to be that particularized.
Give me another way. If the witness doesn't voluntarily disclose,
the committee points to something in the Mueller report indicating that the grand jury had in front of it a particular document, which the committee is unable to obtain through its own investigative procedures. So that example is taken from this court's decision in 1986 in the In Re Sealed Case decision. In that case, there was a SEC enforcement action in the Southern District of New York. The SEC filed an affidavit saying, we want pre-existing grand jury material because we need to get this information. And this court said the generalized need was not good enough, but what might have been good enough was there were a couple documents that the grand jury had that were illegible or which the SEC couldn't otherwise obtain. That's how this works normally.
Well, normally. And Judge Griffith's question, as well as Judge Rao's question, suggested it's not necessarily a normal proceeding for all the reasons that the courts have identified. And that's why I'm trying to understand whether Douglas Oil, what the court was really concerned about is fishing expedition. You know, you just can't have everything because it's relevant. Rather,
right.
There's a burden on you to show particularized need.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't understand the court to be saying that it had to go so far as to identify witness A as to 1, 2, and 3. And as you want to add to my hypothetical, that the committee was unable to obtain that information by other normal discovery means.
I mean, let's just state, then I think we are in agreement that is not how normally Rule 6E works. And the argument is that there ought to be something different under the Douglas Oil test for impeachment proceedings.
But I didn't see anything in the history of Rule 6E or anything you cited to me that goes quite as deep as you're requiring in an impeachment setting.
Right. Well, in the impeachment setting, that's the premise that I want to try to get to. I mean, since you pointed out Douglas Oil, can I point out something particular about Douglas Oil? In Douglas Oil, the court also said specifically, the district court there granted the release of grand jury information, but said, attorney's eyes only, it can be used, no copies may be made, you have to return the information to the Department of Justice when it's done, and it can be only used for impeachment or refreshment of the recollection of witnesses during trial or deposition. Now that is an exercise of the explicit textual power under Rule 6E to impose conditions on the time, manner, or any other condition a district court may impose on the release of grand jury information.
Well, that was explored with the district court here, and the committee volunteered through its legal counsel that it was willing to discuss this. Initially, reveal only to counsel, do it in a staged manner.
Right,
and the department didn't suggest that was an acceptable way to proceed.
Well, because our view is that it isn't a judicial proceeding at all. But if I may, just on this point, I don't think my friend will agree that a district court could impose the kind of conditions that were at issue in Douglas Oil on the House of Representatives or the Senate in the conduct of an impeachment proceeding.
Well, I was going to get to that as well.
But that's a pretty fundamental.
Yes, it is.
And
I thought that's where your irreparable harm argument.
Yes, and on the irreparable harm argument, in addition to just generally the fact that the information is being disclosed, this court has held that once information crosses the event horizon to Congress, that federal courts lack any authority to control it. And that is both an irreparable harm argument as to why we get a stay in this case, but it's also a really fundamental question about whether Rule 6E is meant to deal with congressional proceedings at all, because it is a textual.
Back up. I'm not following your argument about how that relates to the particularized need showing.
Yeah.
Are you saying that increases the burden for?
No. I'm not saying that relates to particularized need. My point is that it is like the fact that the particularized. I'm hearing the court say that the particularized need inquiry seems like a mismatch for what Congress's needs in an impeachment proceeding. And I think that the reason why it feels like a mismatch is that we shouldn't be in this bucket at all. And
well, let's stay in the bucket, though, and we'll talk about it a little bit. We'll get to McKeever in just a second.
But the reason I was making this point about the constitutional limitations on the authority.
I see. Your point is that's an argument for why it's not in this bucket.
Yeah, because that's a fundamental aspect of practice under Rule 6C, is that if a district court allows grand jury information to be released.
See, I would have thought your argument would have been, if you're in that bucket, that it's an increased burden on the House, on the committee, to show particularized need, because once it's out, you're never going to get it back. Speech or debate is going to keep you from getting it back.
If you accept all of the threshold premises,
which
I don't, but if you did,
right.
then yes, I would think that, because it's irreparable once you cross the event horizon. But I think that, again, 6E is a statute, right? I mean, the fact that the district court's basic error in this case was approaching the question as though it was sufficient to find that Congress, in some sense, in a constitutional sense, acts as a court, or that it exercises a form of judicial power. You know, I have questions about that, but you don't need to quarrel with any of that to conclude that we are interpreting 6E as a statute, and that the question is whether this is a judicial proceeding within the meaning of Rule 6E. There are many statutes and rules that regulate trials and judicial proceedings and courts and judgments and convictions. But no one would say, I'm sorry.
So you think it's a different question whether impeachment is a judicial power versus the statutory standard of whether impeachment is a judicial proceeding?
Absolutely, yes. And just let me give you an example. This court said in the Bates case in 1980, that a Federal Maritime Commission proceeding, an adjudicative hearing in front of the Federal Maritime Commission, was not a judicial proceeding within the meaning of 6E. And yet, we know from Justice Thomas's opinion in Federal Maritime Commission versus South Carolina Ports Authority, that for purposes of 11th Amendment immunity, a proceeding in front of the Federal Maritime Commission is the same as a district court lawsuit. So there you have an example of, for constitutional purposes, it's a judicial proceeding, it's a trial, it's a suit. But for Rule 6E purposes, even though there's an adjudication, even though there are people wearing robes, even though there are judgments that are enforceable with legal consequences, it's not a judicial proceeding. We know in the context of Rule 6E that what we're talking about is courts. There's only one other rule in the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure that uses the phrase judicial proceedings. That's Rule 53, and it has to do with broadcasting of video from courtrooms. So what the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure are talking about is procedures in front of courts, state and federal courts. In fact, that's the definition in Rule 1 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure of judge. It doesn't define judicial proceedings, but it defines judge, federal judge, state judge, or local judge.
Isn't that an argument you should be making to the en banc court and not a panel that has to follow McKeever?
So let me address that, Your Honor. I agree with you that if the court thinks that Haldeman and McKeever in combination decide the question, and it's off the table for this panel. I don't think that's right, and let me explain.
Well, explain why I don't think that's right. I mean, however you read McKeever, the result was clear, right? An impeachment proceeding gets grand jury materials. They went at it different ways, whether there's inherent authority or whether it's under the judicial proceeding. But that's the gist of it. I don't think that would last very long.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but I don't think that's right. I mean, everyone understands Haldeman was a petition for mandamus or prohibition by two witnesses. The court held there was no clear or unmistakable right to have the information blocked from its release to Congress. Now, I think if we just start from the premise that the denial of mandamus is not affirmative authority for the opposite proposition, then you know.
But what was the reasoning?
Well, and that's the point.
District court's reasoning? What did Judge McKinnon say?
Well, even Judge Sirica in district court.
I talked about the Court of Appeals when we got to Haldeman.
Judge McKinnon filed a concurrence in part.
Right.
But the en banc court's per curiam order, which was issued the same day that the case was argued, says we're in general agreement with the district court's treatment of the issues. And we feel no need to elaborate on the general treatment of these issues. And I think even Judge Srinivasan, in dissent in McKeever, acknowledged, look, there's no meaningful analysis of Rule 6E in the en banc court's per curiam order itself, and that as the majority pointed out, the underlying district court proceeding itself is ambiguous as to its rationale.
Certainly correct in that sense, that if you look at the Haldeman decision by this court, you're not going to find it. But that decision says we agree with Judge Sirica's analysis, and we find no need to elaborate. And Judge Sirica goes into considerable analysis.
Judge Sirica, the court says we are in general agreement
right.
with the handling of these matters after citing a number of questions, including whether a grand jury can issue a report and various other things. Says we're in general agreement, and we're denying the petition for writs of mandamus and prohibition. And look, if the court thinks that that's a holding, a plenary holding on the merits of this question, then I agree that the judicial proceeding issue is not in front of you. But respectfully, I just don't think it is that. This is an important question that no court of appeals has ever issued a reasoned decision on. And I think the
well, you say clearly held, and I thought that adverb was interesting, that you put it everywhere, that no court has clearly held.
Well, referring to
right, write the adverb.
Sure. Look,
it's
the
held.
Adverb was meant to refer to the mandamus standard.
I understand. But you say that no court has clearly held.
Yes.
And I thought, well, in McKeever, as Judge Griffin has been exploring with you, we interpreted it.
I agree that what McKeever did was characterize the basis for the denial of mandamus in Haldeman. And I think respectfully, that's just not a holding on the merits. The court can tell me otherwise. And I think we're looking at just a couple sentences here, and we all are looking at the same information. But my guess is that, well, just my guess is that the en banc court in Haldeman, having had an issue of that importance briefed to it, decided in 3 days, issued its per curiam order in the same day as oral argument,
What's the significance of that?
You
said that twice now.
You know,
maybe it's because it was so clear to them, right?
It could have been, but my point is, look at that order. It's a few paragraphs on a per curiam basis, and it makes no law at all. And I think the court was, my guess is, the court was trying not to establish circuit precedent, but was saying these petitions denied. Now, the court may know better than I.
Well, in the context, things were moving quickly then.
I agree with it. Yeah.
What was the importance in Haldeman that it wasn't opposed by the Department of Justice to release those materials?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know from the en banc court's order what the importance.
Don't they discuss that in the?
They do discuss that. Yes, they discuss that point.
There was no opposition by the president,
and there was no opposition. I mean, what's the?
It was
what's
not
the
opposed.
Import of that?
Yes, and this is the very first case, to my knowledge. This case is the very first case in which this question is squarely presented in an adversarial posture in an appeal as of right, and for the reasons I was discussing earlier. You just look at the text of the rule, you look at how the rule uses the language, you ask yourself whether it would be constitutional for the rule itself to operate in the manner that the House suggests, because under the text of the rule, they could impose conditions that even the House wouldn't think they could impose. I mean, normally under constitutional avoidance principles, we would read the rule to avoid those consequences. And I don't think my friend, when he stands up, will tell you that he agrees that the district court here could tell the Senate that the grand jury information can only be used for impeachment, or that no copies can be made, or that I have to give it back to the Department of Justice afterwards.
Does that latter point go back to my question about jurisdiction?
I think it may.
Does it relate to that?
I think it may, in the sense that we're asking basically the same question. We're saying there's a fundamental incongruity between Rule 6E and its ordinary operation in, this is a rule of federal criminal procedure, after all, it's a rule of operation in courts, and employing that rule for the purposes for which it's being sought to be employed here. I think the simplest answer to that is to conclude that on ordinary textual ground, you apply the regular rules of statutory construction, that we're not, that a judicial, this is not a judicial proceeding at all, and so 6E isn't implicated. But I think if you conclude that it is implicated, you may have more fundamental questions.
Well, do you give no credence to the notion that when Rule 6E was enacted, it embraced the traditions that had been and the practices that had been outstanding before then?
So Rule 6E was adopted in 1946. At the time it was adopted, there were advisory committee notes that indicated it meant to codify prior practice of the use of grand jury materials in civil cases. The only two cases cited in the advisory committee notes had to do with the use in civil proceedings of information gathered by criminal grand juries. In 1977, when Congress directly enacted Rule 6E, there are extensive legislative reports, not a whisper in those reports about impeachment. What they say that the judicial proceeding exception is designed to address is what you would think. It's the problem of, look, you got a criminal grand jury that through the most extraordinary subpoena power known to American law, has gathered this enormous body of evidence, and civil litigants always want access to it. Of course they do. And the particularized need exception and that standard is about that problem. It is about the problem of how civil litigants or criminal defendants outside of the other terms of the criminal rules get access to accumulated grand jury evidence for federal court proceedings.
So the department's view would be that where there is grand jury evidence, the impeachment process has no way of getting that information because if it comes to the district court will say, well, Rule 68E doesn't apply to impeachment proceedings, and I have no inherent authority to order the department to turn this material over. And therefore, unless a witness who appeared before the grand jury wishes to voluntarily give that testimony to the impeachment committee, there is no way for Congress to get that information?
Under the present rule, under the present text of Rule 6E.
But that is
yes. But yes. And I want to make a point, though. Rule 6E has no constitutional dimension. Congress has directly amended it many times. Congress could amend it to provide for this. And I think, actually, if we back up and you ask yourself, just in the abstract, how would Congress go about providing for access to impeachment? It wouldn't put it under the label judicial proceeding and leave us all to wonder about this. It also wouldn't require itself to show a particularized need.
We don't know how Congress would enact this. Well, the amendment that you say it needs to.
I suspect that of course we don't. That would be for Congress to do. But I think if Congress were to enact an exception to Rule 6E for its own benefit, it likely would not put a district court in the position of policing that. Just as Rule 6E allows for one federal grand jury to give the information to another federal grand jury without going through that gatekeeping function.
Well, wasn't it the position of the Department of Justice in 1985 that imposing such a thing in 6E, adding exceptions, would be unconstitutional or would infringe on the executive's control over grand jury materials?
I'm not aware whether that's the case, Your Honor. I think
there's a 1985 OLC opinion.
I think that the reasons why one might ask about the constitutional scope of grand jury information under Rule 60 are the same reasons that we were just discussing about whether we ought to be in this bucket at all or whether district courts ought to be in this business at all. My point is, if there is to be information, because I think that rationale would then call into doubt the constitutionality of the application of Rule 6E today in this very case.
Yes, it would. But you're also suggesting that Congress might be able to amend the rule in a way that the Department has previously said might be raise serious constitutional problems.
All I'm suggesting is that, as the Court knows, Congress has in other statutes, the Independent Counsel Act, 28 U.S.C. 595C, provided for, required the Independent Counsel to give information to Congress that bearing on impeachment. If you would think at least, if Congress thought that this was so indispensable to its impeachment power, that they would exercise their basic legislative authority and do that. And we wouldn't be here today speculating about whether within a judicial proceeding or exception.
Well, they haven't needed to do that before, have they?
They haven't, Your Honor, but look, it has come up many times that Rule 6E has needed to be amended to address basic fundamental public policy questions. The example that comes to mind is in 2001, after the 9/11 attacks, it suddenly dawned on everyone that 6E didn't allow the Department of Justice.
But I'm talking about an impeachment. Why didn't the executive oppose this before?
We did not oppose it before. It's true that we did not oppose it before.
We've got two examples in recent history.
Yes,
the Department of Justice has not opposed it.
I think the most recent was in 2009 with Judge Porteous
Well, I was thinking of the presidential impeachments.
But we've not opposed it even in judicial impeachments previously. Mm-hmm. And I want to explain why, because I think this is important. As the Court is aware, in the line of cases that includes McKeever, the Department for nearly a decade has been arguing that Rule 6E doesn't have some penumbra about it. You have to read the text according to the text and enforce it according to the text. I've been arguing that case myself personally for a decade. In that, and so, once I should note, under the wise supervision of my former supervisor, with many good things to say, I've been arguing that case for a decade. And you know, our argument in those cases, as you look at our brief from McKeever, you'll see, is that Rule 60 is not a purposive provision. It doesn't allow a court to order the disclosure of grand jury information for any purpose that seems generally consistent with the purposes of the rule. You have to read it like a statute. And when this question arose, candidly, we realized that we had been hypocritical about that. We had been in the impeachment proceedings, proceeding on the same erroneous assumption. And so we've corrected that assumption. But I think it is telling that it is very consistent with the principle we've been arguing for a decade in the inherent authority cases, that you have to read 6E as a statute. And when you do, applying your regular principles of statutory interpretation, you come to the conclusion that an impeachment proceeding is just not a judicial proceeding in the sense of Rule 6E. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the committee.
May it please the court, I'm Douglas Sutter, the General Counsel of the U.S. House of Representatives. With me today are Associate General Counsels Will Haviman and Adam Grog, and then various representatives from the House Judiciary Committee and Georgetown University Law Center Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. If you'll give me 10 seconds for a personal note, please. When I retired from the Justice Department after 40 years, I was replaced by an attorney in part because of my very strong recommendation, and that is Mr. Freeman, who is my friend and I think one of the finest attorneys I've ever met, and I am honored to be appearing in the same lectern with him today.
Well, the court considers itself fortunate to have both of you.
That's kind of you. That's very kind of you. And after this is over, we will shake hands and hug. If I may, I think I should start out with Judge Rao's question because it went to jurisdiction. I'm sorry, I don't want to get poked in the eye with this. Judge Rao asked, I think the problem with saying that there is no, that this is governed by the Walter Nixon case, remember there the Supreme Court held that it was, and by the way, I was the government's lead attorney in that case, the problem is the Supreme Court held that it was a political question how the Senate should go about carrying out impeachment proceedings. That actually just dawned on me where Judge Griffith was the Senate legal counsel at the time. I don't recall.
No, I was not.
Okay. Because I was thinking, he probably knows this much better than I do.
This is a very small town.
Yes.
Very few lawyers.
Isn't it? So the Supreme Court said that's a political question about how the Senate is to carry out its functions. If you said that any application of impeachment is a political question, we would have a major constitutional problem here because we have a rule that says that a court order is needed, but apparently under the argument that it's a political question, would be that Congress, either House, cannot seek or get such an order from a court, and therefore you have the, I think we would all agree, absurd situation of grand jury material would be available to, for instance, newspapers and other private litigants, et cetera, bar examiners, but because of the political question doctrine, it could not under any circumstances be available to Congress, even if Congress passed the statute, as Mr. Freeman is suggesting, because then it would be a political question if Congress ever tried to go to court to get the material. So this cannot possibly be that it would be a political question when Congress is required to go to a court for a court order, as is true here. And by the way, I would just note, not in the Walter Nixon case, in the Richard Nixon case, this court, Judge Sirica and this court, enforced an order. So it would be very strange that the court had done that. One thing I wanted to note right off, before I even start that, I should say, clearly the best argument that I have today is Chief Judge Howell's opinion. Judge Howell issued a lengthy opinion, addressed the various issues. She didn't just make findings that were unsupported, et cetera. She went into considerable detail about particularized need. So anything that I don't cover today, I cannot urge you strongly enough. Please read her opinion. My friend Mr. Freeman was talking about that 6E is a statute. But I want to make sure something is not forgotten here, which is it was passed originally by Congress. It is part of the rules of criminal procedure. Therefore, the Supreme Court can change 6E anytime it wishes. And in fact, the Supreme Court has changed Rule 6E. So Mr. Freeman is suggesting, well, Congress could pass a statute changing 6E. That's true, but the Supreme Court could then change it, and under the Rules Enabling Act, the Supreme Court can overrule statutes. So we would be in this very strange situation of a rule of criminal procedure that is normally done by the Supreme Court interfering with the impeachment authority of both the House and the Senate. And by the way, I do want to emphasize, if the Justice Department's argument is correct, and this is not a judicial proceeding, it's not just the House that can't get the grand jury materials. The Senate, as it is carrying out the trial, and I emphasize that word because, boy, does that seem like a judicial proceeding. Chief Judge Rehnquist, for example, told the senators, you're not jurors, you're a court. Mr. Freeman obviously thinks Chief Judge Rehnquist didn't know what he was talking about, even though he had written a book about impeachment. Okay. So this court also has held that they are judicial proceedings. I'm not fully understanding why anybody would think that this is dictum. Footnote 3, I'll quote very quickly. In any event, we read Haldeman, as did Judge McKinnon in his separate opinion and concurring in part, as fitting within the Rule 6 exception for judicial proceedings. It's a footnote. Judge Howell asked me about that. She says it's a footnote, and I point out, to my knowledge, footnotes by the D.C. Circuit are law. And the court had to reach that point because if it didn't, that changes the court precedent about what Haldeman held. So it needed to reach that point. And therefore, this was a statement that the court makes in its opinion in order to help explain its opinion and give its rationale. I don't know any definition that says that that is not a holding. So that is, to my mind, clear. One also preliminary thing, I appreciated, I think Judge Rogers picked up on this. My friend said the government, which he's obviously used to saying. I'm here for the government. The House of Representatives is the first branch, and therefore it's the Justice Department and the House of Representatives. We're both the government, but we're the first branch. So we get to this major departure.
You're part of the first branch.
I was going to say, half of the first branch. Half of the first branch.
Judge Riffle, I was hoping you would take on the mantle of the Senate then and fill, and we could complete this.
Different obligations.
One of the things that is so key to Judge Howell's opinion is that the reasons for grand jury secrecy and then the reasons why the House is requests and is entitled to the grand jury material here, this way, there's almost nothing here on the side of continuing maintaining grand jury secrecy. We have the grand jury proceedings are over. Mr. Freeman mentioned other proceedings. Other proceedings, as we know, the Stone case just finished. In addition, by the way, the information about in the report that's key about other proceedings, Attorney General Barr already allowed the House to see that material. I saw it. Members of the Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committee saw it because we were allowed to look at the material involving that had been redacted because it involved other proceedings. So that really doesn't wash here. As I say, the grand jury is done. We've moved on to this totally different phase now. The need for this by the House of Representatives is immense.
What's the rule, Mr. Letter? How do we apply Douglas Oil in an impeachment proceeding? What's the rule that you would have us write?
I'm not going to get up here and argue against that we need to make a strong showing. But I think the best way to put it, Your Honor, is that it has to be influenced by the fact that it is an impeachment proceeding, and that goes into the showing, the strength of the need. The House is right now doing...
It still needs to be a particularized need, right?
It does, Your Honor.
So what does that particularized need look like? Give me the language.
Exactly. And the Judge Howell looked at this. Particularized need here is we have, as I forget which of you members of the court noted and Mr. Freeman noted, we have at least two people who have already been convicted of lying to Congress and lying about this. And what are they lying about? They're lying about things that go directly to the Mueller report. Did the president lie? Was the president not truthful in his responses to the Mueller investigation? I believe, if I'm correct, the special counsel said the president has not been has been untruthful in some of his answers. So, and in addition, one of the points
you're into the weeds, and I get it.
I'm sorry,
want the rule. You're arguing that an impeachment inquiry, particularized need, means something special, right?
Yes.
What does it mean? What's the showing? And for future cases, what would be the showing that the legislative branch would need to make to get to grand jury material?
Your Honor, I'm going to stick with the term particularized need. Because that's in the rule. But it means that it is an impeachment proceeding, it is the government's interest is particularly strong, and is it, obviously the key point is it relevant? And it seems to me part of it would be, has the government shown, I'm not going to use the term government, has the House shown that this would be, would go to the issue of should the president be impeached? Does this go to the president's continuing ability to serve properly as the president of the United States? Because that's what an impeachment proceeding is about. And by the way, that's why we hope this court will rule very expeditiously, because we're not just engaged in normal investigative oversight, legislating, et cetera. The House is now trying to determine whether the current president should remain in office. If he should not remain in office, this is something that should happen as soon as possible, because it means that he is undermining the interests and the national security of the United States. So this is something that's unbelievably serious, and it's happening right now very fast.
What does the Mueller report have to do with the proceedings right now? From press accounts, it's all about something different.
And don't believe everything you read in the press, Your Honor. Chief Judge Howell and I discussed this at considerable length. She put it, the impeachment inquiry is in part focusing on what I'll call the Ukraine matter, but it is also absolutely clear, and this is what I said to Chief Judge Howell, is looking at the Mueller report, the Mueller report's discussion of did the president carry out obstruction of justice and related possible bad acts. And that's what, you know, the part two of the Mueller report goes to that very thing. And in fact, as we know, Mr. Mueller indicated there's plenty of evidence that he did obstruct justice. But Mr. Mueller said, but I can't make that determination because of OLC opinion. And that relates to the first part of the Mueller report. And Mr. Freeman, I think, was only talking about volume two. It's both volumes, because in order to determine if the president obstructed justice, you need to look at what did he do, what did he know vis-a-vis election interference by the Russians, what did he know about WikiLeaks. And there's significant evidence that comes out with regard to Roger Stone, but also, and this is a very key point I want to emphasize, one of the redactions, and I obviously have to be very careful to not disclose anything that's not public, but one of the redactions refers to Manafort and Manafort testimony. And so another issue here was possibly the president's responses inconsistent with things that would be in grand jury transcripts involving Manafort. So this
given the stakes involved here, why not a redaction by redaction review? Why not?
I don't think there's any need to go through the many redactions. And
how long would that take? In the district court hearing, Judge Howell said something like, you want to take the whole day to do that? And said no. Is that what it would take? A day-long hearing? Or?
I think it would take longer than that, but we certainly could do that. I don't think that the rule...
What?
We could go redaction by redaction in the Mueller report. There are quite a few of them, particularly in Volume 1, and we could sit down with Judge Howell. Now, one of the problems is, you know, we still don't know what's in the actual grand jury transcripts, but...
Judge Howell said that she had received from the Attorney General an unredacted statement of what was presented to the grand jury, and that she had read that.
That is absolutely correct, Judge Rogers.
And she ruled in light of what she had read. So she didn't disclose anything, and you're not disclosing, but I just wonder, I understood the committee to take a slightly different position on what particularized need required it to show when it was appearing before the district court than you related to Judge Griffith now, in the sense that the 11th Circuit has language about a full and fair inquiry, public trust in the fact that it's a full and fair inquiry, that making decisions about so momentous a matter as to whether to bring charges in the context of an impeachment proceeding requires that the committee have access to all the evidence that is relevant to the inquiries. But it's not that it's enough for the committee to come before the district court and say, we're conducting an impeachment inquiry as to whether the president can properly continue to serve as president. And therefore, we need to see everything that might be relevant to that inquiry. I didn't understand the committee to be taking that broad a position.
Your Honor, I'm happy to be corrected by you. You're exactly right. That's what the 11th Circuit held. And so I'm not sure what the test is, and so I guess I better give more thought to the answer to Judge Griffith's question. I'm not sure what the test would be overall. So Judge Griffith, this might leave you not sure my answer, definitive answer, but in this instance, we have shown, and Judge Howell accepted.
So it's a case-by-case determination that this is not simply a fishing expedition?
Trying
to narrow it down.
That would be a clear part of it, yes, Your Honor. And again, though, it would seem to me that because an impeachment inquiry is whether it's a judge or a cabinet officer or the president should remain in office, that a key aspect of it is the evidence we're looking at, and maybe this is part of determining relevance to the impeachment proceeding.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to focus on the irreparable harm prong. I mean, we do have before us a motion for a stay, and it does seem, you know, as your colleague suggests, that, you know, once the materials are released, well, the secrecy is gone, right? So why isn't that an extremely strong case for irreparable harm in this context?
Your Honor, it's definitely a good argument. I'm not going to pretend it's not, but we have answers. The Judiciary Committee has set up procedures for protection of the grand jury material. I know, for example, the Judiciary Committee received the Watergate roadmap, and to this day, it still has not been disclosed by the Judiciary Committee. Fine. So the Judiciary Committee...
Recent history suggests maybe some norms are not in place, that were in place then.
That could be. The key, though, is...
So what assurance would we have?
The Judiciary Committee has set up procedures to limit access to the material. It would be the members of the two committees.
And if the majority of the committee decided to release, what relief would there be then? What What happens then?
The majority, and as Congress is set up, the majority of the committee can vote to release, and then it would be released. That is absolutely correct. So this is not like...
It seems that our determination doesn't really turn on assuming either the good faith or bad faith efforts of the committee to maintain secrecy.
It does not, because, for example, the Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committee could look at the material and decide that it is so important and so essential that the people of the United States need to have access to this as part of impeachment proceedings. That is true. I cannot say
otherwise. So if the irreparable harm showing is there, and then there are substantial and serious legal questions going to the merits, isn't that sufficient then under this court's precedence for granting a stay?
If that were true here, it would be. It's not true. We have binding circuit precedent, and beyond that, as far as the merits go, we have overwhelming arguments here, a whole history of practice. The Justice Department has, to my knowledge, always agreed until now that this kind of material...
Well, what about on the showing of particularized need? As your friend pointed out, in a colloquy with the district court at the hearing, when she asked you about one particular matter, you said, yeah, you're right, you haven't made a showing there.
Right. That was one matter as to Mr. Flynn, a very minor matter. If the judge went through and looked at other matters and said, well, not clearly not this one. The Justice
Did she
Department,
do that? Did she do that with other matters?
If she did, she did not say. The Justice
Isn't
Department,
that a problem? Isn't that a problem?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because
I mean, it suggests that there needs to be a focused inquiry on each redaction. And the one example we have of that occurring, turns out, didn't need to be redacted.
Your Honor, I don't think...
Wouldn't we have more comfort if we knew, on this abuse of discretion standard, if we knew that sort of inquiry had taken place more widely than just one redaction?
Your Honor, I don't think so, because Judge Howell... obviously looked enough to see what was there one, and she raised that. But other than that, using, as Judge Rogers has pointed out, using what the Justice Department submitted to her, she had an understanding of what is in there. She had clearly had an understanding of that there already had been proven lies that related in part to the president. And as in carrying out an impeachment proceeding, there is a sufficient need and a particularized one for the Judiciary Committee to have this material. And so as for irreparable injury, first of all, the Justice Department is not suffering irreparable injury here. Second, the grand jury secrecy, specifically pursuant to the rule, is breached all the time. This is not some odd thing that almost never happens. This is something that the rules specifically provide.
You're saying there's no general presumption in favor of grand jury secrecy?
Well, the rule provides for it, but it provides
for the exceptions,
which then
narrowly
makes,
construed specific exceptions.
Well, I'm not sure that I would call them narrowly construed. The exceptions are broad and are broadly applied. It is quite common for grand jury material to not remain secret. And in fact, grand jury material is used on a very regular basis publicly in trials by the Justice Department. It just happened again in the Stone case. That's perfectly allowed under the statute, under the rule. I would like to say, in addition, if irreparable injury is the key to today's proceeding, there's a very clear way to solve that. Is this court should simply just look at the merits of the decision and issue a final ruling for the court. We know you can do that kind of thing in the Supreme Court. The Munaf case, M-U-N-A-F, got to the Supreme Court on a preliminary injunction. The petitioners there were raising very serious claims of irreparable injury. They were detained in, they're U.S. citizens detained in Iraq. They said, if we are released, we will be killed. The executive branch wants to release us. The Supreme Court said, okay, we will go straight to the merits, and it held that the actual claims were wrong, they were not cognizable in the court. So the nature of the irreparable injury then was made irrelevant because the Supreme Court made a final decision on the merits.
Well, and let's be clear about irreparable injury. Initially, the department was focusing on the fact that the district court denied the stay. Then it mentioned the fact that its own right to appeal might be mooted. The Supreme Court rejected that. Then today we are told that there are hundreds of investigations out there. But there was no response to my question. What in particular of pending investigations relates to the redacted material that the committee is seeking? So my question is there any burden in asserting irreparable harm to be specific about this, as opposed to a generalized statement that any time you release grand jury testimony, there is irreparable harm? Because the district court looked at one of the purposes of secrecy, like flight, like witness intimidation, and she said there was none of that here, and no basis to assume it would occur, so that the normal concerns that underlie the reason for grand jury secrecy did not apply.
And I'm very glad you brought this up, Your Honor, because remember, a separate reason why General Barr redacted material from the reports was to protect other investigations. That's different from the grand jury one. Then General Barr allowed the Judiciary Committee, the Intelligence Committee, the Speaker of the House, and me to look at those. So we have already seen that. He has already said, go ahead, look at that, and we did that. My memory is there is only one instance when there's an overlap between a claim of 6E and harm to other investigations. So this is a bogus point. The General Barr was not saying we need to have absolute protection for all of these other proceedings. He dealt with that separately, and he has already breached in a way that is what we're asking for here. Can we get the grand jury material in the same way that General Barr allowed us to see the material involving other proceedings that need to be protected?
What's left
appears to be some discussions, particularly in Volume 1. There are all sorts of citations in Volume 1 to various statements that are obviously using grand jury material. In addition, in Volume 1, there are, at one point, I think there's about a third of a page. There are various areas where there are redactions. But remember, I think this is getting lost. Judge Howell ordered a very carefully staged disclosure. As I think was noted before, the Judiciary Committee didn't just ask for everything. We asked for a limited amount of grand jury material. And the first two items we asked for were redactions, grand jury material redactions from the report, and the underlying transcripts provisions or parts that talk about those. And that's all that Judge Howell has ordered disclosed at this point. She said, if after that you want to come back for more, I will consider that. So for now, it's actually a very limited amount that she has required be disclosed in a limited way.
Am I correct that at the district court hearing you indicated the committee would be willing to compromise involving in-camera review? And if I'm right about that,
you are
is
absolutely
the committee
right.
Still?
Yes, Your Honor.
Still interested in that?
Yes. Obviously, we would prefer that Judge Howell's order be enforced. We think it is 100% correct. However, if your honors have concerns and you're not just willing to go to make a decision, we are willing to have that there would be the court would maintain control of the documents and they would be made available on an in-camera basis to staff. And we're trying very hard to carry out an extremely important role of the House while at the same time.
I'm sorry, what do you mean it would be available to staff? I thought this would be part of an argument for the particularized need argument.
It would be available if you're worried about the irreparable injury, saying, well, if all sorts of members of Congress, because the Judiciary Committee and the Intel Committee are very big combined, but we said if the court wanted to limit it, an initial disclosure, and I emphasize that, an initial disclosure to staff from Judiciary Committee and Intelligence Committee.
How about to counsel so that you can make an argument for particularized need? If we weren't satisfied with the argument you've made thus far.
Yes, I would think that I would have to be included in that for that reason, because I represent the House in court. So if we were going to go back to Judge Howell saying, okay, staff has looked at this and the following things should be then disclosed further, we are willing, again, we're trying very hard.
How about just you? How about just the lawyers?
The problem with that, Your Honor, is the staff here are the ones with considerable expertise on what the grand jury materials might show about whether or not the president provided misleading answers to Mueller. I mean, as we know,
remind me what was the discussion at the district court about the in-camera review? Was that what it was? It was.
Yes. Yes, it was this very thing. Will Your Honors give me just one moment to...
This type of negotiation, isn't that ordinarily the type of negotiation that takes place without the intervention of a federal court, right? And the back and forth between Congress and the President over access to information?
Absolutely, Your Honor. What's the accommodation here? They have said, not only are we not going to give you any, we're not going to give it to you because we will be violating the law. Remember, that's their position. It's an absolutist position. They say, you, by law, you cannot have this grand jury material. And I assume, Mr.
But you've
Freeman,
already seen it.
I'm sorry?
You've already seen it. You've
not
seen
the grand jury material,
grand jury
no, Your Honor.
Just
no.
The Mueller report, the unredacted versions of the Mueller report.
We ask for it. We ask that, for instance, the Speaker of the House, we ask that I could see it. We ask that committee members could see it. And we were told no. And I'm not surprised, given their position, their new position that is so inconsistent with many decades of practice. I think their position is they can't show it, and as you know, I believe, Rule 60 is punishable by contempt. And so I assume they would. So there is no accommodation here, Your Honor. We have asked and asked and asked. The accommodation that we were offered was, you know what, we'll give you other material. We'll show you 302s, et cetera. FBI 302s. Judge Howell described that as a farce, and it is a farce. For example, we've never been given 302s of Mr. McGahn. Now, I know now we know. We didn't know then. We know now that Mr. McGahn didn't testify before the grand jury, but we've been given none. The 302s, we've been given a batch of 302s with very heavy redactions. We've asked why the redactions. We did not get an answer. And then recently, because of the letter that Mr. Cipollone sent to the House saying, you're in impeachment, we're not cooperating anymore, I believe we have received absolutely nothing. So if I may, I just want to consult for 1 minute with my colleagues, if Your Honors will give me the moment. I apologize, Your Honors. I just wanted to make absolutely sure that, yes, we continue to get, especially in light of the White House counsel's letter, we continue to get nothing. So there is no accommodation being done here. Again, they're quite worried about, I assume, being placed in contempt. Two, Judge Griffith, absolutely, yes, it would be to counsel my office and counsel for connected to litigation counsel for the committees, the Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary Committee, that would be an initial situation.
If I forget, I'd like Mr. Freeman to address that on rebuttal.
I'd be interested, but I'm guessing he would say you're putting him in a situation of possibly being placed in contempt. And again, the Manafort situation, I think, shows so clearly that there is evidence that, very sadly, that the president might have provided untruthful answers. And this, therefore, is obviously a key part of a possible impeachment inquiry.
Anything further?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Anything further?
Give me one second to look quickly at my notes, please. I think that's it. Thank you so much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel for the department?
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start just with a factual point about access by to the district court had to unredacted versions of the report. The district court did not have volume one of the report in unredacted form. The district court did not see any of that information. The committee had asked us to provide that information ex parte and in camera to the district court, and we did not oppose that. But the district court didn't take us up on that offer. So as she said at the hearing, neither she nor any district judge of the circuit has seen the unredacted Mueller report in its entirety. We did provide one declaration that went through the five redactions in volume two. That's what she had in front of her.
So that is her reference to the ex officio statement she reviewed from the Attorney General?
I'm sorry, I don't follow the ex officio statements from the Attorney General. So
that she reviewed ex officio. The statement from the Attorney General stating what was in the grand jury testimony that had been redacted.
I'm not aware that she had access to anything. She didn't have access to any.
She said she looked at the document that the Attorney General had submitted.
I believe that's a reference to the Weinsheimer Declaration, which is in the record. There's a redacted version in the public record that walked through the basis of the five redactions in volume two. Yes.
Nothing as to volume one.
Thank yes. You. So when the district court recited in her opinion that they had a need to see investigate fully as to the Trump Tower incident or whatever, that was not a finding based on having seen any of the information. She didn't have that information in front of her. Now, the next thing I want to address is to Judge Griffith's question about the ex parte hearing in district court. I believe that was the offer to give it to counsel. We've objected to that for the reasons that we've stated. We did agree that the district court, ex parte in camera, could look at the information if she wished, and we would be amenable to that if we wanted. But there was never an agreement that counsel, that staff could have it, in part because of the reasons I discussed before. As a constitutional matter, once that information goes across the event horizon to Congress, there's no way that the court could regulate the use of it.
To me, in the sense that the Attorney General has already revealed to the committees the redacted information regarding pending investigations, the grand jury is over, that the reason for grand jury secrecy is flight and intimidation of witnesses.
On that point, I just don't think that's right. I mean, those are two of the reasons given.
So I'm giving you the opportunity to tell me what more is involved.
There are at least two other fundamental reasons of grand jury secrecy. One is to ensure the candor of future witnesses to other grand juries, that they...
She dealt with that.
I agree, she addressed it. I don't think it was very persuasive. I mean, look, if you just ask yourself...
I understand you may not agree with her, but the question was, she clearly erroneous in making that finding?
Well, no,
Think it's a question of law?
I do think it's a question of law if what she said is there's no reason for grand jury secrecy, and so they can have all relevant evidence. That's the...
Well, in the context that she'd been dealing with at the hearing and through all the parties' pleadings, I mean, this is not, you know, go look at anything you want. That's what I'm trying to get across.
It's not a fishing expedition. Oh, Your Honor.
Given the Mueller report and the specification, which I understand you say was not enough, but there was specification that the district court found was adequate as to why the need
So if I may, no. I think the fact that there was an extremely detailed Mueller report cuts against disclosure rather than in favor. I think the showing that they had an interest, again, if you just look at the words that district court used, investigate fully, to complete the story, those are never words this court would accept in the context of a regular judicial proceeding. And I think when we just saw that, when my friend was standing here at the podium, we asked him, what is the standard? He said, well, I actually couldn't tell you what the standard ought to be for impeachment proceedings. And he said, it would have to be a case-by-case analysis. It's not a fishing expedition, but we don't know what particularized need is unless the district court looks.
But Mr. Freeman, how would the House Judiciary Committee make the showing of particularized need without being able to see the unredacted material?
So I think in the same way that litigants generally do, so for example, if they had, they have many, I'm not privy to this information, but I understand they have many, many witnesses coming and testifying in closed session, and if a witness came and testified in closed session, that they said something to the grand jury, and another public witness had said something inconsistent with that, they could come in and say, we have these two things, we understand that there's grand jury testimony on the subject.
How would they know it was inconsistent?
What? I'm sorry?
How would they know it was inconsistent?
Well, this is exactly the point that...
That's your point. If the witnesses voluntarily indicate somehow, and the committee could say, well, that's inconsistent with what was said by another witness.
Your Honor, if you look at like Douglas Oil, the case talks about what is the usual, what is the typical particularized need? It's to impeach testimony at trial and to refresh the recollection of witnesses at trial. It is not to use grand jury information in a case in chief to prove some proposition of law. Those are the normal ways that this works. And the basic problem here is what they're saying is they want this information to prove an affirmative proposition of law as part of an investigation.
To determine, I mean, the interesting thing to me is, why wouldn't the department favor giving this information? Because arguably it will show, as the president keeps saying, he did nothing wrong. In other words, the House does not want to return a charge where the evidence would not support it. I mean, that's a standard prosecutorial requirement.
Right, and normally you have to show that there's a basis in Rule 6E to turn over this information. My friend is correct. It's enforceable by contempt of court. And again, that just circles back to my original point. I think it beggars the imagination to imagine that when an order that the district court issues, that you would hold the House or the Senate in contempt of court for not following, in the same way that you would normally hold a regular party in contempt for not following an order of a district court in a Rule 6 case.
Mr. Freeman, I'm interested in your thoughts about, Mr. Letter said that if we're focused on irreparable injury, then we should just move straight to the merits here.
Yes.
I'm wondering what you think about his suggestion.
So I think a couple of things about that suggestion. I agree that this court has that authority. I've never seen in 15 years of practice here the court decide the merits of an appeal on the basis of stay motions. You have in front of you two 5,000-word submissions, less than half the length of a merits brief, on two fundamental and important questions of federal law. We would be prepared to proceed on any expedited schedule the court thought was appropriate, but we do think that the court ought to stay the disclosure order pending the resolution of that proceeding. The last thing I just note is my friend had a colloquy with Judge Rogers regarding irreparable injury, and Judge Rogers said, well, what is the specific injury to a particular pending proceeding? And I just want to push back on that. That is not how grand jury secrecy, irreparable harm normally works. If a district court ordered us to publish all of the Mueller grand jury information in the newspaper, we wouldn't have to show you that there was a particular criminal proceeding that was going to be jeopardized by that order in order to seek a stay pending appeal.
So it's enough for you just to say irreparable harm?
It's right? Not just that irreparable harm, it's that there's a reason why we protect grand jury secrecy.
And you've been through it. You've given me three reasons.
And then there's another, which is part of what the grand jury does is investigate and sometimes conclude that people should not be indicted. And that one of the points of grand jury secrecy is to protect the rights of the innocent. Now, I have not seen the grand jury information in this case, so I can't represent to you one way or another what it includes. But we don't require the very divulgence of the information at issue in order to determine there would be no irreparable injury from its disclosure. This is an important question the court has substantial arguments on the merits and a strong showing of irreparable injury. I submit that in any regular circumstance, the court would grant a stay pending appeal here, and we respectfully ask you to do so in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement. Stand, please.